Well, good to see each of you back again tonight. I say again, we've got some folks that weren't here this morning. It's good to see my friends, the Camusos here. Love that family. John and I went to Dublin together many years, probably more years than I want to try to figure out back, and some other folks too as well. So good to have each of you here. We're in the middle of a creation investigation, a little one-day seminar, and we're going to finish it off tonight by talking about absolute truth. I don't know if you guys can kick off those front lights, or is it going to be too dark if we do that? If it'll be too dark, then, those are the ones. There you go. That's much better. Is that a little better for you guys out there to see that? Okay. So absolute truth. Absolute truth. Do we believe in absolute truth? I hope you do. But I hope you're also prepared to be able to defend this concept, because this is a concept today that's under tremendous attack in the philosophical circles of our time. And every age, every era has its challenges of just kind of, frankly, foolishness that kind of makes its way up into academia or into common thought. And today we have postmodernists. Well, by way of kind of jumping into this topic, I want to ask a couple of questions, make sure everybody's awake and with us here tonight. So here's the first question. This one will get you thinking just a little bit. Why did Jesus come into the world? Now, there's not just one right answer to that. So somebody take a stab at it. Tell me what you think. Why did Jesus come into the world? Yes, Brother Tom. Very good. There's a biblical answer. To seek and to save that which was lost. Very good. Somebody else. That's right. Christ came over and over and over again. We see him saying, "It is written," and he came to be obedient, to be submissive to God the Father. Yes, that's right. Jesus came to die, right? So oftentimes we think he came to really be a good example and to live a wonderful example for his disciples, and that's all true. But really, ultimately, he came as the Passover lamb. Right from the beginning, he came to die. Yes, sister. Okay, to show God's love. Yes, he was a demonstration. Howard? To fulfill Scripture. Yep, so many Scriptures in the Old Testament speak of the Messiah coming. Yes, Will. Oh, okay, so to receive some glory of men, we know that Magi came and worshipped him, others worshipped him. So he didn't get an awful lot of that during his first advent. He'll get a lot more in the second advent, but he certainly did get some, yes. So he came to reveal the Father, right? He was the Word. I think it's Hebrews 1 that says, "Hath in these last days spoken to us by his Son," talking about God. And so many different reasons, but I want to mention a particular scene here where Jesus himself says, "To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world." What is this scene? This is a scene of a courtroom. And here it is, a very strange scene. Jesus, who is the very creator of everything on this earth, is being placed on trial before an earthly judge. And the angels had to be looking at this with just absolute amazement. Like, who would have thought the Messiah would finally come, and here he is placed on trial, the only one that's ever lived a perfect life, and he's on trial in front of a bunch of sinful people. A crazy scene, a bizarre scene, a surreal scene. And Jesus, through most of the night, says nothing. And finally, he gets ready to make a statement, and it's almost like you can see the angels looking over like, what's he going to say now? And he makes this statement, "To this end was I born, and for this cause I came into the world." Does anybody know how to finish the verse? Yes. Pretty good. There it is. "That I should bear witness unto the truth." John 18:37. So that's at least one of the major reasons why Jesus came into the world. Now, that might beg another question, which is this: why did Jesus need to witness to the truth? Anybody want to take a stab at that one? Rich?
Well, in times past, he had sent prophets to correct the nation of Israel, and there would be peace for 40 years, and then they would fall down and send another prophet to them, and now he himself has come as a prophet.
Right, and so obviously the people had gone pretty far astray. Again, there's a lot of different answers we could give here. God's truth was under attack. There was a message of truth God wanted to give to the world. The world was deluded by lies. Here's a question. Think about this one for a minute. Would a man, what a person, who knows the truth, so they know what the truth is, deliberately choose to believe a lie? Would somebody do that, purposely believe something that's not true? William's saying yes. Okay, so a lot of you guys saying yes. We have, I'm sorry? Somebody mentioned politics. Okay, we won't go there tonight. But we have Romans 1:25, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshiped and served the creature more than the creator. Do we have people out there that are worshiping the creation more than the creator? Yes, we got lots of those around today, right? And so they've turned the whole thing upside down and backwards, and they don't want to acknowledge a creator, but they want to make a lot of the creation and how wonderful the trees are. And, you know, I saw a bumper sticker the other day. It was dirt worshiper. Well, now that takes tree hugger like one step further, dirt worshiper. So I'm just thinking this guy with a big pile of dirt in his living room, you know, doing these things in the morning. Dirt worshiper. I mean, come on. Hopefully a worm will come out so he at least has something living to worship, right? But we have an assault on the truth that's active today, an assault on the truth. Genesis chapter 3, verse 4 tells us it's nothing new. We got the first lie all the way back in the Garden of Eden. Who remembers what it is? What was the world's first lie? Thou shalt not surely die, right? The world's first lie. Hath God really said? Oh, God said this. Oh, thou shalt not surely die. And so doubting God's word, and it was directly from Satan. And in John chapter 8, verses 44 to 45, Satan is called the father of lies. Well, I would like to take us to the book of Isaiah again this evening. Somebody, do a little sword drill here, find Isaiah 59:14. The first person that finds it, read it for us. Isaiah 59:14. We won't be version specific here, so whatever version you've got, we'll take it. Isaiah 59:14. Very interesting word picture here that the prophet Isaiah paints. It talks about this time where truth is fallen in the streets. Now, truth is not like a statue. It's not like the statue of Saddam Hussein. Some of you maybe remember the statue of Saddam Hussein getting pulled down and people like running up and spanking their shoes on the thing, you know, and it getting pulled down through the streets and people jumping on it and stuff. I mean, truth is an abstract. Right? I mean, we know what it is, but it's not like you can actually kind of walk up to it and touch it and pat it on the head or something. But yet the prophet says that it's almost like it was a physical thing that had fallen in the streets and was of so little value that people are stepping on it. So there was this time in Israel's history where truth was no longer valued. Can I suggest, my friends, that we're pretty much at that same point in this country today? Unfortunately. There used to be a time where a man's word was his bond, and all you had to do was look him in the eye, and if he's looking you in the eye, and you're both shaking on it, that's it. It settled it. You didn't have to have 17 attorneys, you know, and witnesses, and 9 pages of documents with footnotes to keep people honest. I mean, just people were trustworthy. And even if it wasn't in their best interest, well, I'd promised, you know, I shook the guy's hand and, you know, it is what it is. That's how it's going to be. I'm just going to do it. But truth had fallen in the streets. And so today we live in a postmodern pluralistic society. Well, what on earth is a postmodern pluralistic society? Some kind of cool words there. Well, pluralistic just means that we've got lots of different traditions, lots of different backgrounds going on, lots of different worldviews, lots of different perspectives, kind of all mixed in one society, kind of happily and sometimes not so happily kind of coexisting. But this word postmodern here is a way of thinking. It's a philosophy. It's the spirit of the age, say. And so I want to just kind of give you a little bit of what a postmodernist is. Now, here are some leading luminaries in the world of postmodernism. Richard Rorty is one of them. He says this: there are, to be true, a few cowboys who still believe in old-fashioned, honest-to-goodness, absolute truth. But thankfully, they are rare. Now, I would count myself as one of those cowboys that still believes in old-fashioned, honest-to-goodness, absolute truth. And they're probably not as rare as Richard Rorty likes to think. But he's a postmodernist, and that's what he's saying. Well, let me perhaps illustrate what postmodernism is with some umpires. It's springtime. It's the season of baseball, right? So let's pretend we've got some umpires here. And the first umpire that we're going to use by way of illustration is the classical umpire, or you could call them the pre-modern umpire. And here is an umpire, and he steps up to the plate and he says this. Remember, this is a classical guy. Think of the divine right of kings, that great classical age. And the pre-modern umpire says this: there are balls and there are strikes, and I call them the way they are. There are balls and there are strikes, and I call them the way they are. In other words, shut up, I just called it a strike. Shut up, I just called it a ball. It is what I say it is. So very absolute, kind of hierarchical and structured and authoritative. That was kind of the classical way of thinking. You know, and there's still parts of the world today. If you're in North Korea, well, this is kind of how society is structured, right? And you could even say in some of the Muslim countries, it's very much this way as well. But in the Western thinking, this would be the pre-modern era. And then you have the modern era, the modern scientific era, and lo and behold, some of the classical laws, whether it was the laws of the cosmos or whether it was relativity coming into a classical physics, we said, well, wait a minute, maybe things aren't quite as buttoned down as we thought. When you get to particle level, things behave a little strangely. And so, some of these things began to be questioned. And so in the modern era, we have an umpire, and he comes up and he says this: there are balls and there are strikes, and I call them the way I see them. There are balls and there are strikes, and I call them the way I see them. So there are absolutely some rules here, but I admit that, I'm doing the best I can, and I may be a little fallible, and, well, that's why we have instant replay, right? And so there's some admission for the fact that, okay, things might be a little relative, a little hard to call, sometimes a judgment call, and so, is it a ball or is it a strike? It might be on the line. And so the modern umpire gets a little bit more sophisticated about it. But then the modern umpire starts to fade off the scene, and here comes a postmodern umpire. Remember, this is the thinking in academia today. And here's what the postmodern umpire says. He says, they ain't nothing until I call them. There's no such thing as a ball. There's no such thing as a strike. There is no truth. It's just whatever I say it is. And then it becomes that. Now, question, can we really play a baseball game this way? If I decide I'm going to play a basketball game and there are no rules, you can run up and down out of bounds, you can kind of bounce off the wall, you can thump one of the opponents and they take him off in a stretcher and you just come on down through, you hike the ball, sometimes you dribble it, sometimes you don't, sometimes you just like herd rush, one of the guys that got, in your face a little bit. Can you play basketball that way? I mean, it ceases to be a game, right? There have to be rules. But the postmodernists don't like rules. And they don't always carry to that crazy extreme that I'm mentioning, but they tend to be very skeptical of rules, especially traditional rules. Here's another leading luminary in postmodernism, and he says this. This is Jean-Francois Lyotard. Simplifying to the extreme, I define postmodernism as an incredulity to meta-narratives. Does that help you out? Well, incredulity means a disbelief or a lack of, concurring with, and of course, meta-narratives. Now, does somebody know what on earth is a meta-narrative? Who knows? Yes?
It's like a big picture story.
Yes, a big story, meta, big narrative story. So, can somebody give me an example of a meta-narrative? So creation, Christianity, big overarching story with moral implications and worldviews and, right and wrong and kind of absolute truth and a bit structure to it. That's a meta-narrative. Can you give me an example of another meta-narrative?
Well,
Maybe a competing meta-narrative out in the world. Yes.
Humanism.
Humanism, right? That's another one. Somebody else. Tom, do you have one? Nope. Tom made a little motion. And this is like the, that's right, you scratch your neck, something like that, you just up the bid. You ever go to one of these Southern auctions? The guy goes like this, and he just went from 5,000 to 6,000, just like that. He's buying it, taking it home, right? You better not move. I'll pick on you. Isaac, you're getting close with that cup of coffee. All right. So a meta-narrative is a big story. Islam is a meta-narrative. Evolution is a meta-narrative. These folks don't have any great fondness for evolution either. They're skeptical of anybody that goes out there and makes any big claims that are supposed to hold for everybody and everywhere and has some big story about life, the universe, and everything. They're skeptical of anything like that. And they're all about celebrating tribalism and lots of little stories. And, hey, this guy's got his opinion. Now, shut up. Let's all get his. Oh, that's very nice. So you believe the universe was sneezed out of the nose of a purple dragon. Wonderful. That's just amazing, you know. So that should be taught right alongside evolution and creation. That's just beautiful, you know. Tom? I think it certainly plays into it. Yeah, I think it certainly plays into it. We want to be real careful, you know, like how horrible is it when the census has only two genders on there? I mean, that's just so bad. That's just sticking people, forcing them into these terrible, and we should see lots of different varieties and options and maybe just have a blank where somebody could fill in what they, just how they feel at the moment, you know, might be different next time. So that's postmodern thinking. Now, here's Alan Bloom, and he's not a postmodernist, but he kind of sees this coming, and he says this: more interesting is the coexistence of these opposing sentiments in the most advanced minds of our day. The same people who struggle to save the snail darter and worry about hunting deer defend abortion. The principle of contradiction has been repealed. So, I mean, how can they fit these things in their head at the same time? You know, how can you build a logical, cohesive thought if you are able to entertain, you know, contradictions? Maybe some of you saw this. This was just about a year ago, last year, March of 2017. This Time magazine, a front cover, Is Truth Dead? We live in a day where lying is called spin, where deception is okay, so long as you get away with it. Nobody's hurt. Truth is of little value. No wonder Time magazine, March 2017, asks, is truth dead? Let me tell a story about a witch. I moved to my neighborhood about a dozen years ago or so, and one of the first things we did is we began to go up and down the street calling on our neighbors. Now, I admire people that go door to door. That's great. You know, I've done it. I've done some of it. You know, get together Saturday morning and go door to door through the neighborhood or do surveys and stuff. That's wonderful. I haven't found it real productive, personally, over the years. So I'm not knocking it by any means. But it is really good in your neighborhood. And if you haven't, you ought to do it. You ought to go out and meet your neighbors. So I'd get one of my kids, and it's just great if you get a kid. Then it's even better, you know. But you come down through, and you knock on the door, and people open the door about that much. Like you just see the white of their eyeballs. And you say, hey, I'm Dave. I just moved to the neighborhood, and this is my son, Jonathan. And then, well, what are they going to do? I mean, you're a neighbor, and you're there to meet the neighbors, and you're saying hi. And so they kind of open the door, and they give you a few minutes to talk to you, you know. And I'm just asking you, how long have you been in the neighborhood? You guys go to church anywhere here? I'd work my way up to that, you know. And then I try to give them a tract, a gospel tract, or maybe even share the plan of salvation. So one day, Jonathan and I were going down, and we're knocking on doors, you know. And we're several, you know, doors down one direction. This only works maybe for, you know, a couple, 3-4 miles. After that, you kind of cease to be neighbors. But so we're going out one direction, and we're maybe a mile or so, mile and a half down in East Concord. And we open the door, and this lady says, oh, hey, come on in. I said, well, actually, well, you know, we'll stay here. She said, well, okay, well, come on, sit down on the porch. So we sit on the porch, and so I get into talking about things. And I mentioned that we're Christian. She says, well, that's wonderful. Well, I'm a witch. I'm looking at Jonathan. He's kind of looking at me. His eyes go, boink! I'm like, don't make any fast moves. She's maybe got the pin right there. She's going to put it in the doll. Blah! You know? A witch! My neighbor! This is bad, right? So I'm thinking, and my mind's going, and I'm thinking, how can I get out of here, right? And I mean, a witch! And so I begin to ask her, you know, well, so what does that mean? And she says, well, it means I believe in Wiccan, you know, and this is wonderful. We really are into the earth. And she said, look at my yard, for example. Look how beautiful all the flowers. Well, the yard was a complete mess of weeds and tangles and vines. And yeah, it's beautiful kind of in a way, but it was just kind of completely gone to seed. And she says, you Christians, you're always dissing the world. This is heaven. The world is beautiful. And we just need to feel the force and the power and the goodness in all the world. And I said to her, I said, well, you know, you're healthy, you're young, you've got a nice house, you got your freedom here in this country, you got a job. I guess she told me she worked in this, you know, counseling service at the hospital. And I said, what if you were sick? And, you know, what if you were, you know, debilitated and maybe, you know, you were suffering tremendous hardship or you were starving in some other country and stuff? You might not think it's so great. I said, you might be actually looking forward to heaven and a place to be a little bit better. And she says, no. So I asked her about truth. I said, you believe in absolute truth? I'll never forget what she said. Here's what she said. I actually wrote it down when I got back. She said, I don't believe in absolute morality or absolute truth. Some people see only black and white. Those folks end up in my suicidal counseling service. I see lots of gray. And she told me, I love the gray. It's beautiful and lets you affirm all different people. And hey, we can all agree with each other. It doesn't matter what your perspective, I can agree with you. Because I don't have to have absolutes. And I don't have to be right or you be wrong. I can just kind of affirm people and we can all get along really great. And it just sounded really interesting. But then I said, well, wait a minute. I said, but if there's no blacks and whites, you know, we have red lights and we have green lights for a good reason. I mean, the yellow, that's the gray. I mean, that's where the accidents happen. I don't want to be living there. Right? And then I said to her, I said, well, what if somebody broke into your house? What if I broke into your house some night and I killed all your kids and I took all your stuff and I went off? I mean, how would you feel about me saying, well, that was just my perspective. Can you just affirm me? Well, you'd be the first one to say, that's wrong. Lock that guy up and throw away the key. Well, but wait a minute. How can you say that's wrong if there aren't any wrongs and rights? So she kind of started working her way through it, you know, and, you know, some stuff. But this was her whole perspective. Can I submit to you that more and more of our neighbors think this way? So for postmodernists, they don't like claims to truth or assertions that certain beliefs are wrong. They prefer discourse like, well, I think, or what if, or let me share my experience. And so typically, they're happy to have you share what Jesus did for you. Well, that's wonderful. But that doesn't apply to me. See, there's more and more of this out there. They're open and tolerant to you telling a story, but if you say certain behavior is wrong, like homosexuality, oh, you are so horrible to have said that was wrong. You tell about your experience and your preference, but let's let it be preference. Don't you say what they're doing is wrong. Now, folks, there is no need to purposely be offensive in our approach, but at the end of the day, we must deal with the issue of truth. This is important. This is important. So how do we answer someone like the witch who says there is no truth? There are no absolutes. How would you respond? Can I give you a methodology that I think would be helpful to you? This is an argument that's called the Roadrunner argument. How many of you have ever seen Looney Tunes? Okay, everybody seen Looney Tunes? Okay, so this will help stick in your mind. So let's say this is the Roadrunner. Typically, it's not the Roadrunner. Typically, it's Wile E. Coyote going off the cliff. But let's just say the Roadrunner comes running along, and he goes off the cliff. Now, in the world of Looney Tunes, does he immediately fall to the ground? Some people are saying yes. Some people are shaking their heads. Why not, Isaac? Why does he not fall to the ground?
He's still running.
Something has to happen before he falls. This is very important in the physics of, yes. He's got to know. He's got to first be like spinning his wheel, like he's going nowhere, and then he looks down, and then he sees. The reason he's moving nowhere is he's in thin air. He's got to see it. Otherwise, gravity has no hold on him until he sees it. And then when he notices it, then what happens? Then he sinks down, right? So he goes down, boom. So this argument is to postmodernism like what happens to the Roadrunner. It just kind of pulls the ground under underneath them. So somebody comes along like my witch friend and says, there is no absolute truth. Here's how I want you to respond. Is that an absolute statement? Is that an absolute statement? Now let's say they say, well, yes, that's I said it, right? So, yes. Well, they've just established at least one absolute truth. Right? Or claim to. And what if they say, well, no, it isn't? Well, then they just said it's not true. You see, the statement, there is no absolute truth, is a self-defeating statement. It is logically incoherent. It makes no sense. So we shouldn't be taking a back seat to these guys with doctorate degrees and philosophical, you know, esteem of their peers and higher academia. We shouldn't be embarrassed to be old-fashioned cowboys that are for truth. See? And you just ask a little question like this, and all of a sudden, poop, it's like a pin, and all the air goes out of the balloon. All right, let's take you back to this scene that we started. Jesus Christ on trial before an earthly judge. And so Jesus stands up and he says, for this cause was I born, that I should bear witness to the truth. Does anybody remember how Governor Pilate responded to that statement? John 18:38, yes. What is truth? Exactly. And so here's Pilate, and he's thinking, and Jesus makes the statement that he makes, and Pilate perhaps thinks about it for a second, and then says this, what is truth? And I don't think he was saying it like, sir, can you explain to me what truth is? I think he's saying, psh, what's truth? You see, because Pilate, he's kind of from a multicultural background too. Here he was in Rome. He's a Roman citizen. He's a Roman governor. And the Romans worshipped the Caesar as God. And he had a Greek education. And, of course, the Greeks believed in a whole pantheon of gods, Zeus and Hercules and Athena and all these different gods. And now he's serving in Israel as a governor where they're fiercely monotheistic. There's one God. And he's saying, what's truth? Right? Like who knows? And he walks away. R.C. Sproul said this, when Pilate walked away from Jesus with a cynical retort, he forsook the greatest authority ever on the greatest question of all time. What is truth? Folks, this is important. This is a key question, and Pilate missed the opportunity to get an answer directly from the lips of the Creator himself. Well, all that is introduction. It's the longest introduction of any talks I have. So we're going to go quickly now, but I want to briefly talk about three things. Defining truth, what is truth? Determining truth, and defending truth. Defining, determining, and defending truth. Let's talk about defining truth for just a minute. Universal truth exists as surely as God exists. So if God says it's true, it is. John 14, verse 6, Jesus said this, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. Now, that would be viewed as pretty insensitive, arrogant, condescending, intolerant even, in today's society. For someone not just to say that they actually have a handle on what's true and applies to everybody, but to say, I am the truth, they'd probably crucify him all over again if he was alive today. But that's what he said. And my friends, either he was right or he was wrong. That's what we have to decide. We can't change what he said and make him say something more popular in today's society. We have to either accept it or reject it. Those are our two choices. See? And by the way, the nature of reality is not up for popular vote. Just because a given philosophy or worldview or thinking is popular today does not make it true. Reality is reality in the classical era and in the modern era and in the postmodern era. It hasn't changed. It's always been the same. You say, well, we understand some things that they didn't understand. I agree, but those things always were. They just got it wrong, see? And I think there's some things that maybe they got right that we're getting wrong today. And the Bible can help us by arbitrating to know what the truth is. So on this idea of defining truth, somebody give me a definition of truth. In your own words, what do you think truth is? Ends up being a little harder to define than you might think. Somebody give it to me. What do you think truth is? Yes, William? Okay, something that we can really show with evidence, a kind of a scientific approach to it, yes? The actual thing. Ooh, I kind of like that. It's actual. Okay, you can go out, check it out, and shows to be actual.
Tim Bird describes it as that which corresponds to reality.
Ooh, now he's real close to what I would say, and this is kind of something from Ravi Zacharias and R.C. Sproul a little bit. Here's how I like to say it. Truth is that which affirms the nature of reality as it is. Or we could say as it's perceived by God. Truth is that which affirms the nature of reality as it is. So I'm making a statement, and it actually is affirming reality. We could check it out, and it works. Now, Ravi Zacharias is a pretty interesting fellow. He goes all around the world, and he gives talks on philosophy. And as you might imagine, he's run into postmodernism along the way. And one of the stories Ravi likes to tell is this time when he went to a particular college. And this college had a school of philosophy, pretty big school, and they had just built a new facility. And he was a little bit early, and so the person that was taking him around, his MC, was saying, would you like to come down and see our brand new school of philosophy? And so Ravi said, sure. So they went on down, and you start to approach this building, and it's kind of weird. Like, there are multiple doors. Most of the doors lead nowhere. You just open them, and there's like a brick wall there. So you kind of have to find, you kind of remember which one is like the actual entrance to the building. And then you go in, there's windows that just don't look at anything. There's just like a wall behind them. And there's staircases that kind of go up, and they just end. They don't go anywhere. And so this guy's looking over at Ravi like, what do you think? It exemplifies the nature of the world. There's no purpose. There's no rhyme or reason. There's no right and wrong. It just kind of is out there, and there's lots of different roads you can take, some of which are productive, some of which maybe aren't. And Ravi said, I have just one question. Did they do the same thing with the foundation? Now, you know the answer to the question. If they had built the foundation willy-nilly, you wouldn't get an occupancy permit. Like, no one would want to go in there because at any moment it would fall and collapse, right? But see, this is the kind of silliness that goes on. We want to have a structured, ordered society so we know when to stop at stoplights. We don't want criminals breaking into our house and stealing everything and killing people. But then we want to say there's no right and wrong. There are no rules. There are no absolutes. Everything is relative. You see how it's contradictory? And so we want this postmodern ornaments to hang on our tree, but in reality, you can't live life that way. See? And so it's fundamentally contradictory, defining truth. Well, let's move on to determining truth. So if we agree absolute truth exists, here's the next question. Can we know it? Since we don't always have God's complete knowledge, we must admit that many of our dearly held propositions are true within a certain degree of uncertainty. That's the nature of historical truth. For example, we have a recollection that we can't always easily go back and confirm. Okay, who can I pick on here? Pick on my friend Dave Chamberlain here. Give Floyd a break tonight just for the fun of it. Not that he deserves it. Dave, what was the day of your birth? You don't have to tell me the year if you don't want to, but what's your birthday?
October
31st. Okay, he says October 31st. Now, how sure are you? Would you say you're kind of 50-50, 75%, 99%? Are you 100% sure?
I'm 100%. You're
100% sure. Is it possible, David, that the doctor's watch was running 5 minutes fast that night? And it was kind of close to midnight, and he's looking at it, and he's saying, oh, we just squeaked this guy in, and he got the date wrong by 5 minutes. Is it possible, is it conceivable that that could possibly happen?
Yeah.
He's not buying it. Could it be that the doctor smudged? He's going to write down the date and a 2 kind of became a 3 or a 7 kind of became a 2. Is that, I mean, could it be possible something like that happened? Okay. And see, this is the kind of game that these guys will play in philosophy class to the point where you can't really be sure, 100% sure of anything. See? And that's where they want to get the students, so then they can kind of say, well, there is no truth. See? They try to, you know, cast doubt on these things and say, well, everything's relative. You can't be 100% certain of anything. See? And really, they usually go with historical truth because that's the most challenging. So, maybe truth out there, but can we know it? Now I want to give you a metaphor by a fella, and I want you to think about this and tell me whether you like it or not. This is the cathedral metaphor by a guy by the name of Forrest Church. Now how about that? He's a minister and his name is Church. Isn't that a cool name for a minister? Reverend Church. I go to church at Reverend Church's church. And he's probably the most famous Unitarian minister in the country. He died not too long ago. But one of the things he was famous for was his cathedral metaphor. Now listen to this metaphor and tell me what you think. Here's what he said. In the cathedral of the world, there are millions of windows, each telling its own story of who we are and where we came from, where we're going, each illustrating life's meaning. Every religious, philosophical, even scientific worldview has a window, or many windows, through which the one light shines, refracting truth, bringing illumination to worshipers and seekers. No one can see the one light. Truth or God, call it what you will, directly, only as refracted through the cathedral windows. Very beautiful, very picturesque sort of metaphor, this cathedral metaphor. What do you think of it? Well, let me ask you this. Does he believe in truth? Some saying no. Some saying yes. Why would you say yes?
He's saying there's a specific light that would be the truth.
Yeah, and he actually capitalized it, right? He says, no one can see the one light, truth, or God, call it what you will. So he kind of says, it's out there, but can we know it?
It's impersonal,
but more than just the nature of it out there. Yes, it's kind of impersonal. He kind of, God, truth, or light. But can we know it?
Not directly.
Why not?
There's a filter.
It's colored, right? So someone's over here. He's kind of looking through this cathedral window. He's trying to get an angle on it, but it's looking a little blue because he's kind of looking through some, you know, blue pigmentation there in that glass. Someone over there has got another window, and it's a little yellow, and he's looking through it, and he's getting a perspective. And maybe we can learn a little bit from the Hindus and maybe from the Muslims over here and the secular humanists. And somebody way up top there, he's got a slightly different angle. He's looking down on it. Maybe he's a scientist, and he has a kind of angle on it. And all these things can help us, and well, that's wonderful, and we can all get a little picture of this thing, but we can never all kind of quite get our arms completely around it. And you kind of maybe say, well, yeah, I guess we've never quite figured it all out, and maybe he's onto something here. It's bunk! It's garbage. How are we going to respond to this guy that says you can't know the truth? Well, let's bring back our friend the Roadrunner. Here's Forrest Church, and he says, the truth is out there, but you can't know it. Now, what should we do in response to Mr. Church, who says nobody can know the truth?
How can that be a truthful?
Yeah, well, something like that. Is that statement itself true? Goodbye. Boom, right? Because if he says yes, he's claiming he knows the truth. Wait a minute. What window are you looking out of? If he says it's not true, what, it's still bunk? See how foolish it is? And yet it's thought so learned and so tolerant and so wonderful and affirming and big-hearted and magnanimous and all. It's garbage. How do you know, Dave? How can you be so strong? Well, I say again, can we know the truth? 1 Timothy 2:4 says, who will have all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. Doesn't mean we know everything or we'll ever know everything, but it does mean we can know some things for 100% sure. There was a case in court here back a few years ago. I think it was 2012, maybe. This postmodernism showed up in court. And, it was 2012. And this government contractor was accused of wrongdoing. And he stated in court, "I don't really have any questions directed towards him, a particular witness, because he has his own truth and I have my own truth." The judge wisely replied, "Well, there's a real truth out there, and that's what I'm here for, is to try to find that. It may not be what your truth is, but there's a real truth out there somewhere." So how do we determine truth? Well, when we start to look at truth, there's different kinds of truth. True, by definition, would be one kind. Mathematics would be of this character. Does 1 plus 1 equal 2? Yeah. Why? Because we defined it that way. That's how we built our system up. Do you spell tree, T-R-E-E? Well, yes. Why? Well, because we kind of all agree that's the way we're going to spell it, right? So this is true by definition. Then there's also scientific truth, which we could also put into the group with historical truth. And, excuse me, we can sometimes go back and confirm these things to some degree, right? We can go in the laboratory and test somebody else's theory, and we can kind of prove it out for ourselves and say, yeah, it's valid. Sometimes it's not so easy to do. Like, how do we know there was a Julius Caesar? There's only like a couple references in a couple of history books to this guy, right? So as far as we know, but maybe archaeologists will dig further and get some more validation, historical truth. And so we try to validate these things and repeat these things, and we build up a body of knowledge that way. But then, my friends, there's a whole different category called revealed truth. And this is where my scientific friends kind of pull their hair out at me. Like, how can you just go into this ancient book, thousands of years old, and just read something and say, oh, okay, that changes my whole mind on science. There wasn't a big bang. Or man came out of the dust of the ground. I mean, really? You're going to go to a thousand-year-old book? I mean, you're not going to your laboratory, you're not going to the field, you're just going to believe that? Well, yes. Why? Well, because it's God's word. And they just go, ah, you got to be kidding me, right? But for those of us who have personally experienced the power of God's word and the transforming work of Jesus Christ in our life, this is authoritative. It settles the issue. That's not a popular viewpoint out there today. But that has to be what we communicate to people. We can't sugarcoat that. Or we just lost historic Christianity. Fundamentalism is out the door, right? Determining truth. Truth is discovered, not invented, always was there. It exists independently of our knowledge of it. You may know about it, you may not know of it, it's still there. Truth is transcultural. What's true is here, it's true in Saudi Arabia, it's true in Russia, it's true in Ethiopia, it's true all over the world. Somebody comes along and says, well, wait a minute, if I talk about the way a woman is dressed and characterized as modest, that's going to be very different in Saudi Arabia than here. Okay, well, that's something that is got a reference in it. So it's maybe modest to us here, but may not be modest to them in Saudi Arabia. So we have to be careful with that. But truth itself is unchanging. And nearly all truth is absolute. It's absolute truth. So it's absolutely true that this dress standard is modest in the United States. It's absolutely true that that dress standard is modest in Saudi Arabia. Somebody in the back room says it's hot in here. Somebody in the front of the room says, no, it's cold in here. Well, which is it? Well, it's hot to that person and it's kind of cold to that person. But if we got a thermometer, we get an absolute truth, which is, here's the temperature, right? So when you're referring to somebody, you have to be careful because that referent is part of the truth statement. See, so you can kind of get thrown off sometimes with that. Well, I want to just wrap things up by talking about the Apostle Paul. I'm sorry, the Apostle John. The Apostle John, as I began to study this matter of truth out to some degree, it just fascinated me that he was fixated on the truth. By the way, he's called the Apostle that Jesus loved, maybe because of his love for the truth. The word true is found in John's writing 18 times, six times more than all the other gospel writers combined. The word truth appears in 18 times in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, three little epistles. It's almost like he's fixated on the truth. So let's just look at some of these instances. John chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning was the Word." Literally a communication, a truth statement. Jesus Christ is God's truth statement to us. John 4:23, worship in spirit and in truth. It's to be characteristic of our worship. John 5:19, we read, truly, truly, or verily, verily. By the way, this is mentioned in God, in John's writing 25 times. He's the only one that uses verily, verily, or truly, truly. And he mentions it 25 times. In 2 John chapter 4, he uses this phrase, walking in the truth. Think about that for a minute. How do you walk in the truth? Sometimes we just read these things and we just kind of pass over them and we don't stop and say, well, wait a minute, what does that mean? I think of the Charlie Brown character. What's the guy's name who carries a dust cloud with him? Wherever he's walking, the cloud's going, right? And Pigpen, right? Are we so wrapped up in the truth that wherever we go, there's like a little aura around us, like this person is committed to the truth? No matter what you might think, it might make you look down on them, but they're going to give you the truth, right? They're candid. They're honest. That's just the way they are. They're just, you can't penetrate it. It's this little aura that goes with them. They're going to be truthful. Is that characterize my life and your life? John, 3 John 12, he talks about someone who has a good report of the truth. Well, this is a really interesting thing. It's almost like truth is a teacher, and they're doing a report card, and they're grading you on the truth. Well, if that was the case, how would you do today? Would you be a person that is so truthful in your words that you would get a good report of truth? Revelation 3:14 says this, the true one, of course, talking about God. So we've established there's absolute truth. It's under assault. In today's day and age, we determine one can know the truth. The question remains, what should we do about it? Will this be a high priority in our lives? Is this going to be important to you and me in the way we set up our lives? There's some young people here today. Is this going to be a foundational point in your life? Truth. Well, John chapter 8, verse 32 says this. Knowing the truth makes you free. Somebody referenced this earlier. I'm trying to remember whether it was here in the service tonight or in the prayer time, but somebody said that we might know the truth and be free. There's a freedom to it. If nothing else, you can sleep well at night. You don't have to remember, okay, oh man, I'm going to meet so-and-so this morning. What lie did I tell them last time? And I got to kind of remember what, you know, I said to them and kind of make my story match, you know, because otherwise they're going to know I'm a complete fabricator, right? And so it makes you free. You want freedom? Be a person of the truth. Proverbs 23:23 says, buy the truth and sell it not. Hang on to it like something that's really valuable. So my question is, are you personally committed to truthfulness in your words? Maybe we could think about it just the last 24 hours or the last week or so. Perhaps there's some lady here and one of your girlfriends comes walking up to you and says, hey, how do you like my new hairdo? And you look at her and you think, that is the ugliest haircut that person has ever gotten. And you say, oh, it's very nice. At least say it's interesting. Fascinating. Amazing. Different. And I'll go with that one too. Someone calls on the telephone and your kids answer and say, it's Uncle Jimmy. And you say, tell him I'm not home. What are you teaching your kids? Truth. Are we committed to truthfulness in our words, or is it okay to bend the truth when it comes to just convenience and just getting through the day and making everybody feel good and no one's going to get hurt by it? See, this is something that hits home right where we live every day. Are we truthful? This is what God had to deal with me in my heart. I mean, I was a salesman. Yo, everybody's a salesman kind of bends the truth, right? It's almost as bad as politicians. And they're just one step removed from lawyers, which is might as well be liars, right? So, I mean, truthful. Are we truthful in our words? Does this matter to God? Oh, you bet. Jeremiah chapter 5 and verse 1, the prophet says this. Run ye to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem and see now and know and seek in the broad places thereof if ye can find a man. There be any that executes judgment and seeks the truth and I will pardon it. What's God saying? It's the same time as Isaiah and truth had fallen in the streets. And God tells Jeremiah, look, You go out, you go through the whole city of Jerusalem. If you can find one person, one solitary man or woman who's committed to truth, I'll pardon the whole city. I'll let them all go. I'll let them all off on the judgment that I've planned. Find one. And they couldn't find one. That's bad. What if it came down to it for Ware, New Hampshire, or Henniker, or South Ware, or Sutton, or wherever you're from, Hopkinton? And God said, man, this place is so bad. Can you find one person that's really committed to the truth? Would they find you and me? And say, oh, I'll pardon it because here's this one. And they're still committed to it. They're hanging for me. See, this is important to God. God was willing to pardon the whole city if there was one person who was committed to the truth. So defending the truth is important. When we think of the spiritual armor, Ephesians chapter 6, and you put on the spiritual armor, and of course you got the shield of faith and the helmet of salvation. What's the first piece of spiritual armor that they're supposed to put on? Does anybody know? The first one listed, yes. Very good, having your loins girt about with truth. That's the first one that's listed. It's kind of like foundational because everything builds on that. It's like you get up in the morning and you open that drawer that has you-know-what in it and you put it on and you start from there up, right? And you don't have to worry about color coordinating because no one's going to ever see it but you. And so it goes on first and then basically from there you build it up. And that's the way we should be in the morning spiritually. Like the first thing we put on is truth. So God, I don't know what's going to happen to me today. I don't know where I'm going to go. I don't know what I'm going to face today. But just right off from the bat, God, I'm saying I want to be committed to the truth today. That will set you several steps ahead in the spiritual fight. Young person, it'll set the whole course for your life. Whether you're going to be committed to being a person of the truth. This is a big deal to God, and it's obviously not a big deal in our society today. So the first piece of spiritual armor is the belt of truth. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 11 talks about the end times. And it says the end times, there will be a lie. There'll be a great lie. There'll be a great deception. I personally think we're fixing up for the end times. We're pretty close. Things are setting up. You know, when Time Magazine runs a front page and the front cover is truth dead, I think we're close to the end times. What about you? Are you willing to stand for the truth? Is this going to be something that you're going to make a big deal of in your life? Is it something you're going to ingrain in your children? Is it something that you're going to insist on in your friends to be a person of the truth? Let's go ahead and close in prayer.